is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
He loved his fellow men and women. He loved the church, but he also loved his country. Go well, good and faithful servant. You will be sorely missed.
That was South African President Cyril Ramaphosa on the death of Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who was a recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize for his fight against apartheid and human rights abuses. Details coming up. Also, Somali leaders have once again delayed the country's election, paving the way for a political crisis. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Archbishop Desmond Tutu passed away yesterday at the age of 90. Tutu was a leader of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa and became internationally known as a voice of calm, reason, and moral authority. He received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984. VOA journalist Darren Taylor reported on Tutu's work for years. He shared his memories of the Archbishop with editor Kate Pond Dawson. In the first part of a two-part discussion, Darren talks about what Tutu meant for South Africa.
Well, I think, Kate, in the 1980s, especially in the 1980s, especially, that was the height of apartheid, when there was a lot of violence throughout South Africa, and a great many atrocities were committed, especially in the 1980s. I think at that time, Tutu held the country together. Mandela was in jail. A lot of the other ANC leaders were exiled. There were very few political leaders actually inside South Africa. There was the banned United Democratic Front, but as soon as one of them did something or opened their mouths, the apartheid government would throw them in jail, whereas Archbishop Tutu, in a lot of ways, was untouchable. But at the same time, he was respected by all sides because he had that moral voice. Okay, he was a religious figure, but obviously, he chose sides, and his side was against apartheid. He was fighting for the rights of all South Africans. But always, wherever he would go, he would make a point of speaking to all races. He wouldn't play to the audience, for example, like a United Democratic Front or an African National Congress person would have done. He spoke to all South Africans at the same time. And I know, I remember as a child, a teenager in the 1980s, watching Tutu on television going from funeral to funeral of apartheid activists who'd been murdered by the government, by the National Party government. And I remember all the speeches he used to give, and all the time he was preaching peace. And I remember at one time too, there was a very, very angry crowd that was African National Congress crowd at a funeral just outside Johannesburg, and they identified someone in the crowd who they labeled an informer. They used to call them impimpis. Now, they found this guy. Whether or not he was an informer or not is a matter still up for debate. But anyway, they were going to murder him by placing a tire filled with petrol around his neck and setting it alight. And I remember Archbishop Tutu and a colleague fighting their way through the crowd to actually stop the crowd from killing these guys and chastising them, you know, like little kids, for using that method to try to kill the guy. And he was preaching non-violence at the same time, but at the same time inspiring people to act for what they believed in and to protest. And so that's what I remember from the 1980s, is him basically holding the struggle together while a lot of the other political leaders were in jail, and keeping the spirit going and keeping people's spirits up. And yeah, it was just a tumultuous, crazy time. But all the time he was in the background helping people and guiding people.
That was VOA reporter Darren Taylor in Johannesburg speaking with our colleague Kate Bond-Dawson. Tomorrow, Darren will share the lighter side of Desmond Tutu. Condolences are pouring in from across the world following the death of South African anti-apartheid icon, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Tutu died peacefully at a care center in Cape Town yesterday at the age of 90. His foundation has lined up a number of celebration activities ahead of his burial on Saturday. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
A human rights defender, a priest, an ordinary human being, an unequaled patriot, and a South African giant. This is how many of the condolence messages describe the late Desmond Tutu. President Cyril Ramaphosa yesterday addressed the nation, describing him as an illustrious, courageous, and outstanding patriot.
It is a time to pay respects to the departed and to celebrate life with the exuberance. He loved his fellow men and women. He loved the church, but he also loved his country. Go well, good and faithful servant. You will be sorely missed.
Anglican priest Stephen Moreo echoed those sentiments to VOA.
His legacy will be his love for all people. He has always said that God is not God of Christians. God is God of all people. So his main legacy is his love for all God's people.
Ordinary South Africans have also praised him for speaking truth to power in defense of the poor. 69-year-old Amukele Chakela's house is a stone's throw from Tutu's old residency along Vilakazi Street in Johannesburg's Soweto Township. She told VOA how Tutu was a good neighbor and a blessing to her family.
Even his family, they were very kind people. So, you know, people like this, really, it's not easy to find a person. He was a nice somebody. He was joking with Mom Tutu in the morning. And then you'll see him passing, go and buy newspaper. You'll see him walking on Sunday, goes to the church. He was man of God.
Another Soweto resident, Noma Tamsa Ngafagela, who sells wares to tourists next to Tutu's old house, told VOA that it is through people like Tutu and former President Nelson Mandela that South Africa is free today.
It's an honor and privilege that I am walking freely in Vilakazi Street because of what Desmond Tutu and Mandela have fought for.
Current and former heads of states, church leaders, human rights defenders, and renowned world bodies from across the globe have sent their condolences. The Vatican described him as a promoter of racial equality and reconciliation. Former U.S. President Barack Obama portrayed him as grounded in the struggle for liberation and justice. And UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called him a towering global figure for peace and justice. A week of mourning has been declared ahead of the burial on Saturday. A memorial service will be held on Wednesday. Tutu's body will lie in state at the St. George's Cathedral on Friday. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Bickering Somali leaders have once again disagreed on already delayed elections in the Horn of Africa country, paving the way for another political crisis as the international community calls for dialogue to speed up the electoral process. Mohamed Kayi reports from the capital, Mogadishu.
Somali President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, popularly known as Farmajo, and his Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble have argued again over the process, which is already behind the schedule. The head of state blamed the Prime Minister for failing to uphold a mandate to lead the country through elections, based on what has to come to be known as the September 17 Agreement of 2020. The agreement will allow 101 delegates to select the members of parliament who will choose the next head of state. In response, the Prime Minister rejected the call and maintained his commitment to lead a free and fair election process. Roble added that Farmajo's criticism is aimed at disrupting the ongoing process. The members of the opposition were quick to throw their weight behind the Prime Minister, who was tasked with conducting the elections following a political agreement on governing the process back in May. Former President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud, who is among key candidates challenging the incumbent, reiterated the significance of expediting the electoral process to avoid setbacks. He said, "We don't have other options than that of the Prime Minister in convening the National Consultative Forum to discuss the challenges on the disagreed poll process, which we have been stressing from day one." Somali security agencies, backed by the African Union peacekeepers, have beefed up the security during the electoral process, but the experts warn that the continued spat involving the country's leadership is concerning. Dahir Koro is a political analyst who believes there is a need for quick steps forward.
The Somali citizens are losing confidence in their leadership over continued election wrangles. The international community is also frustrated with the lack of commitment by the leaders. On the other hand, the threats by Al-Shabaab is growing. Therefore, there's need for compromise in order to conduct credible polls.
This latest political crisis linked to elections comes as hundreds of Somalis affected by the severe drought wait for humanitarian assistance. Drought and famine in Somalia have been attributed to climate change. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
After an argument over the voting, the president suspended the prime minister yesterday for alleged corruption. The prime minister called it a coup attempt. The Chinese government is promoting Chinese language and culture through Confucius Institute programs worldwide, including in Africa. Some educators say they are concerned about what they say is censorship in Chinese-funded programs. Victoria Munga reports from Nairobi.
Steve Wakoli has been working for 3 years to perfect his skills in Kung Fu, a popular martial art taught at the Kenyatta University Confucius Institute. He's also a teacher at the institute, where hundreds of students are learning about Chinese culture and language at the facility named after the ancient Chinese philosopher whose teachings are a cornerstone of life in East Asia. There are about 525 Chinese-funded Confucius Institutes worldwide, including 54 in Africa, according to a 2019 U.S. Senate report by the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Jacob Ratemo is one of more than 500 students enrolled here. He says learning about Chinese language and culture will help him find better work, but Ratemo acknowledges the classes avoid subjects that are politically sensitive in China.
But the advantage is, I think, especially when you're in university level, you can access such matters. You know, I can go to VOA News and on a regular basis and see what is going on in China, or I can go to Google and get that information. So, yes, I can admit there are a few challenges when you ask those questions to the Chinese themselves.
According to the Senate report, Confucius Institute funding comes with strings that can compromise academic freedom. For example, the Chinese teacher signed contracts with Beijing, pledging not to damage China's national interests. Confucius Institute management turned down VOA's request for comment. Teacher Wakoli says the institute's syllabus does not allow much time for politically sensitive topics and debate. But analysts say the Confucius Institute suppressed discussions on topics like Taiwan and Hong Kong to protect their funding from the Chinese government. Martin Olo is a political analyst in Kenya.
Indeed, there have been issues around whether or not the institute is being used to propound what would be seen as anti-democracy, anti-human rights. And those concerns are founded in terms of what is the official Chinese policy on Taiwan, on Hong Kong.
China considers Taiwan a wayward province and has not ruled out the use of force to reunite it with the mainland. Beijing imposed a national security law for Hong Kong in 2020, and many forms of dissent are criminalized. Educator Jonathan Wesaya told VOA that the institutes are doing injustice to students by limiting their learning and exposure to different ideas.
Yes, the opportunity comes in through the Confucius Institute, funded by China. That is okay. But can you get, as an individual, to talk about Taiwan, talk about Hong Kong, talk about Korea, talk about North Korea and South Korea and how they relate, and how the whole bigger picture fits into the geopolitics of today?
With so many signing up for classes at the Confucius Institute, education experts say it's critical that students find other avenues to learn about topics that Beijing may consider politically sensitive. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Libya's Interior Ministry and the local Red Crescent say the bodies of more than three dozen migrants have been recovered after drowning while trying to cross the Mediterranean to Europe, including 27 that washed up on Libya's coastline. Libya is a major transit point for migrants, many from African countries who are seeking better opportunities in Europe. The Red Crescent in the western Libyan port of Qoms says 17 bodies, including that of an infant, were recovered from the shore at nearby Alus on Saturday, and that another 10 bodies were found on a different beach. The Interior Ministry says 14 bodies had been recovered from a group of 60 people believed missing at sea. For more, VOA's Chinedu Ofor spoke with reporter Ruud Almendorp, who has covered several migrant rescue operations.
For a sad reality is that it's quite a risky adventure to go on a small flimsy boat and then make the journey usually to the island of Lampedusa, because that's Italy, and that's 300 kilometers. So you have to imagine it's a small boat that maybe goes 20 kilometers per hour. So you're looking at least 15 hours of going over the sea with a small boat with many people. And often the engine breaks down, or the fuel finishes, something happens, or the boat gets in disorder because it starts deflating. And if you look all of that, then it's a very high chance that a very tragic event like this happens. And it happens. And it's not always reported. And now suddenly it is. And that's a very sad thing that happened.
Could this tragedy have been prevented?
That's very difficult, because you're talking about a very big area. And so the only prevention would be is to stop boats departing, but that's not realistic. People just want to go to Europe, or they see it as the only way out. So the only way to overcome tragedies like this is to stop migration, but that's not something which is realistic.
What about cracking down on those who are responsible for carrying these migrants, the boat operators, those who are paid to ferry these migrants across? Can't something be done about that?
Yeah, but that would involve a very serious effort from within Libya, and that currently the government is not really strong. There are several factions active, and the guys who are operating those small boats, they often work in conjunction with local landlords. So they also have some kind of security details themselves. So it's an apparatus within Libya, and that's one thing. Because it's fed by the big wish of migrants of going to Europe. Either they want to go to Europe, or they see a ship out of Libya as the only way out of the situation they are. So you can crack down on those small ships, but they will find ways to do it, because the demand is there. So as long as the demand is there, the migration will continue one way or another.
Do you think this latest tragedy would deter or slow down the flow of migrants?
That question is often being asked also in relation to rescue operations exacerbating the number of migrants choosing to go to sea because they hope to be rescued. But what you see is when the ships are not there, like for example when COVID-19 started, there was not so much traffic on the sea anymore in terms of ships and rescue boats, is that the migrants kept coming, even though they knew very well that the chance to be rescued was very little, but they still went. they still went. The wish to move out is so big that it's stronger than any factual report you get.
That's reporter Orud Almandorp speaking with VOA's Chinedua 4 from Nairobi. In November, the U.S. State Department removed Nigeria from its list of the worst violators of religious freedom. But the move has been met with criticism by some Nigerians who say the decision was hasty given that many Nigerians say their freedoms are still being violated. From Abuja, Munachi Chuks has the story.
The decision to remove Nigeria from the list of religious freedom violators has met with mixed reactions from some Christian leaders. A statement by the Christian Association of Nigeria says their followers are still facing persecution from Boko Haram and other terrorist groups. Pastor Adebayo Oladeji is the spokesman of the association. He told VOA that the removal of Nigeria from the list is unjustifiable and says that the government has failed to tackle religiously motivated abuses and persecution.
We still have government policies that are not in tune with freedom of religion. In Nigeria of today, so many states, especially in the northern part of the country, where Christians are not allowed to buy land to build churches. Our children in public schools, especially in primary and secondary schools, are not allowed to study Christian religious knowledge.
Oladeji is calling on the U.S. government to compel Nigeria to uphold the right to freedom of religion.
Let the U.S. government put a prayer on Nigerian government to revisit all these areas where we identify. If they ask us to come for any meeting where we can present this fact and figure, we are ready to do that.
Reverend Abdul Alam of Maranathan World Leadership Church called the decision to remove Nigeria from the list of those who violate religious freedom untimely.
I personally think it's premature because the facts on the ground do not show that the decision was very helpful in the long run. Because I know friends of mine who are pastors who have been picked up by the DSS, who have been threatened.
The Bishop of the Goddess Church of Nigeria, Ufoma Bernard, has a different view. He commends the U.S. government for removing Nigeria from the State Department's list.
In the first place, Nigeria shouldn't have been placed in the list of violators at all. Me thinks that Nigeria was placed in that list as a result of the Christian lobby, as a result of the Pentecostal lobby, rather, you know, which for me it's very, very insensitive and very, very inappropriate.
Nigeria has been plagued for years by a rising tide of violence that has left places of worship burned, families torn apart, and people held captive by terrorists. Last year, Nigeria was added to the State Department's special watch list. It's a category for countries that tolerate violations of religious freedom, but that don't reach the level of what the department calls countries of particular concern. For VOA News, Munachi Chuks.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Nihayus Wuhid in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.